Teach Me to Code, episode 57. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week I'm going to be talking to Jamis Buck. You might know Jamis. He's the guy that started Capistrano. He wrote the SQLite Ruby library. He's been involved in the community for like 6 or 7 years. Works at 37 Signals with David Heinemeier Hansen and several other awesome people. And he's just kind of a brilliant programmer. It's interesting. The first time I had heard of Jamis was before I was actually in the Ruby community. I was working at Brigham Young University in their IT department, which is where he used to work. And so I'd heard of him several times before I actually got out and wound up doing tech support at Mozy and then learning Ruby and jumping ship on tech support. So anyway, first off, I want to remind you about our sponsor. We have NewRelic.com. New Relic is a terrific tool. They are great for monitoring and managing your application. They'll tell you where problems are occurring. They'll tell you where you're having load issues, where things are slowing down or getting overwhelmed or overloaded. They give you stats on your servers. Just a terrific tool. So if you want to check them out, go to NewRelic.com. Tell them that you heard about it on the Teach Me to Code podcast. I'm going to go ahead and jump into the interview at this point, and we'll pick you up on the other end. One other thing I want to remind you or to tell you is that I changed up the music. I'm sure you could tell. Let me know what you think. Come to the podcast site, teachmetocode.com/podcast, and leave a comment. Let me know. All right, we'll get to the interview, and we'll come back and pick this up after we talk to Jamis. Hey everybody, this is Charles Max Wood with, I'm sitting here with Jamis Buck. He is pretty well known for working for a small company that no one's ever heard of called 37 Signals. He's also worked on Capistrano and several other libraries that I think several people use. And most recently on his blog, I've been reading it here, he's been working on some maze algorithms. And he also, there are a few things that I personally kind of appreciate from Jamis. He was one of the guys that started the users group that I attend for Ruby, and he also came down and talked to us recently, and it was kind of interesting what he had to say. So we're probably going to delve into that a little bit, but I just want to welcome you to the podcast, Jamis.
Well, thanks, Chuck.
Is there anything that you want to mention that I didn't?
No, you flattered me plenty.
So, first off, it was interesting. You came down, you talked to the Utah Ruby Users Group, and you talked to us about the test unit versus RSpec kind of debate that was going on. Mm-hmm. That was sparked by, I guess he's your boss, David Heinemeier Hansen.
Yeah, so don't ask me to say anything bad, right?
Right. I'll ask your honest opinion, you can lie.
Okay.
Anyway, so I'm a little curious. You were talking a little bit about why we use specific tools or why don't you use specific tools. And I'm a little bit curious as to what you use and why you use it. Let's just talk about testing for the moment.
Okay. I use Test Unit because that's kind of what Rails uses. And when I first started working at 37 Signals and working with Rails, that's kind of where we started, and haven't had a lot of motivation to look elsewhere. I've tinkered with RSpec, but that's really about it. Mm-hmm. So I use Test Unit because it works, and yeah, I haven't felt a big need for anything more.
That makes sense. Are there any tools that you've used where you've actually switched from one to another because there was a reason like that you can think of?
I used Vim for a long time and then switched to TextMate because it had the project management features. It had like the project drawer and the quick find and things like that. I then switched back to Vim actually about 3 years ago because I missed how rapidly I could work in Vim. Like I'd spent years building up the muscle memory and learning the shortcuts, and I missed some features like the split windows and things like that that mm-hmm. TextMate didn't provide. So I switched back to Vim. So I've kind of gone back and forth on that tool.
That makes sense. And so you switched mainly because you thought it would make a difference in your workflow, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I missed how quickly I could do certain things in Vim. Like, it may, like, some of the things may sound silly, but just like being able, I don't know, are you a Vimmer? I don't know.
A little bit. I've done a little bit of Vim, Emacs, and TextMate. I'm an expert of none.
Okay. Well, like in Vim, how you can hit the dot to repeat your last command. I missed some things like that. And like I said, split windows and a few other things. Of course, moving to Vim, I then missed the quick find that TextMate had. And so I made a substitute for that. But yeah, Vim's been great for me ever since. So.
Huh, interesting. So have you done any of the Vim golf or any of those?
A little bit, not as much as I want to. I always forget about it, honestly, but I think it's a brilliant idea. It's a great way to practice and learn new techniques and to be humble. I thought I was pretty good until I tried one of the Vim golf things, and I didn't even come close to the top score.
Right. So I'm a little curious then, is that why you're doing the mazes and things like that? Is that just kind of keep things sharp, or is it due to an interest, or... Both,
there's an interest there. I mean, I tend to meander when I learn things, and so I'd actually been going through the Seven Languages in 7 Weeks book. Is that Bruce Tate?
I've heard of it. Want to do it, but yeah.
Yeah, great book. I went through it. Actually, I got about halfway through it. I went through I/O and Scala, and I started realizing, you know, the projects he has you do. Are, you know, they introduce you to the language features, but they don't let me dig as deep as I want. And I remembered playing with maze algorithms to learn Ruby and some others. And so I was like, well, I'm going to try that. And so I started doing maze algorithms again and started doing some more research and decided I'd share what I found and kind of got sucked in there. And it took me a few other places. And so, yeah, it's not out of any particular passion I have for mazes. It's mostly just it was very interesting to me at the time. And I actually haven't done much with it in the last month and a half or 2 months, but
yeah, I noticed that your last post was about a month and a half ago.
Yeah, there's more I could post. I just haven't found the motivation to post it. Yeah. So
I'm also a little curious as to for a while it seemed like you were on a big kick with the string. What are
no,
they?
No, string figures.
Yeah. What prompted that?
Actually, my wife picked up a. One of those Klutz books, you know, the board ones that for kids, and it was for string figures. I think it had 4 figures in it, like Cat's Cradle and some others. And I just kind of working through it with my kids, and I was like, "This is kind of interesting. I wonder what other information there is online about it." And of course, that opened the floodgates, and I found about the International String Figure Association and several books that had been written, and I just kind of started diving. And like I do, I tend to go very deep when I explore something. I'll go down as far as I can. So, yeah, I try to specialize rather than a lot of breadth to my knowledge, but I carry a string in my pocket. I still play with it. I haven't been as vocal about it.
Right.
Yeah, it's still fun to do.
So have you found, I mean, what's the benefit or what have you seen any substantial benefits from diving deep into this kind of stuff? Not necessarily string, I guess that too, but just anything. As opposed to learning a lot of technologies, is there more advantage, do you think, to diving deep on a particular technology or on the maze algorithms or learning a wide
range? Well, I mean, the advantage is you know more about it, right? Like if I just said, I want to do a maze and I learned one maze algorithm, then there I am, I can do mazes with one maze algorithm. But now I can do mazes in 11 maze algorithms. And I can do weave mazes and braided mazes and, you know, various different ways to employ the algorithms. Is that better or worse? It depends. I tend to feel, and it's just my personality, I feel incomplete if I've left a stone unturned. I like to really know. Like when I first started learning Rails, I dug deep into it and I did a few posts about some Rails internals, like the routing and the active record find. This was probably 4 years ago, so it's all out of date now. But it's just kind of how I work, and it's mostly just to satisfy my own needs, as opposed to actual like I don't do it because I think it'll benefit me in some way, other than it'll teach me something. So
right. So you work for 37 Signals as a programmer.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into Ruby or Rails initially?
Well, I first found Ruby. I was actually working for BYU at the time, and we'd been doing stuff with C, web development in C, which was actually a lot of fun. But I was kind of wanting to try new things, and so I found Python and tinkered with Python for a few months and liked some things about it, didn't like other things about it, and so I kept looking, and I stumbled on Ruby. This was about 2001, and taught myself that and tinkered on it and really started feeling passionate about it. I went to the 2004 Ruby conference, which is where I met David. He was presenting on Rails.
Right.
More about the motivations behind Rails than the actual technical details. But he and I got to talking, and at the time he was looking for he was wanting to have Rails be the entire thing, like including a SQLite database and everything. And so we talked because I'd done the SQLite Ruby bindings.
Right.
And so he was wondering about the possibilities there. I wrote the first version of the SQLite bindings for Rails, SQLite adapter for Rails. And he later decided that, you know, it wasn't practical necessarily to embed the entire database with Rails. But that kind of started our talking and my first looking into Rails. And, of course, then shortly after that, I was hired by 37 Signals and been doing Rails ever since. So,
huh, that's interesting. It's interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that the first time I'd ever heard of Jameis Buck was actually when I was working for the Office of Information Technology at BYU. And I'd heard about this Ruby language, and you know, and he used to be here, and he was an awesome guy, and that, you know, that was about it. But yeah, I'd heard of you before I'd really ever gotten involved with Ruby. So,
wow! So my legacy reaches wide.
Yeah, apparently.
Well, cool.
Yeah. So I'm a little curious too about Capistrano. First, I want to just talk a little bit about what prompted you to build it. I mean, was there a problem that you were trying to solve at 37 Signals? Mm-hmm. Or was it just, oh, gee, I wonder if I can do this with Ruby?
Some of both. I mean, NetSSH, which is fundamental to Capistrano, that was a, gee, I wonder if I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun.
I'll bet.
Learned a ton about the SSH protocol. And it kind of paved the way for me then when I was hired and David asked me to look into a deployment script. Because at the time, I mean, I don't know if you've heard the story or not, but Basecamp originally ran on one server, application, database, everything on one server. And then when I was hired, Basecamp was actually running on two servers. And that, you know, when it's one server, deployment is not a problem.
Right.
When it's two servers, it starts getting a little sticky. And so David had written a little, I can't remember if it was a Ruby script or a shell script or something that we would just run and it would push out to each server and restart. And it wasn't that painful, but we knew that eventually we were going to get more and more. And so one of the things when I was hired is David asked me to look into a deployment system to deploy to multiple servers. And I went through a couple of iterations before I came up with Capistrano. And then of course it evolved from there.
Right.
So yeah, it was built on, we needed something at 37 Signals. And honestly, we've never used very many of the deep features, which were added because other people asked for them or submitted patches.
Right.
But the core, we still use it regularly.
Huh. So I'm a little curious as to what it's like to maintain a project that's used by so many people.
Stressful. I found it stressful. largely because there was no team behind Capistrano. It was just me. I tried a few times to enlist people to help, but you know, people didn't even submit many patches. It was just a lot of feature requests mostly. And it's hard to blame them because NetSSH especially is pretty complicated.
Right.
And you know, if you're just consuming NetSSH, it's not too bad, but it's still kind of confusing in places. Anyway.
Right.
But anyway, so a lot of it fell to me, and it was kind of stressful, honestly. Rails, I think there's more of a team there, so you don't feel as much of the stress individually.
Right.
At least I didn't when I was a core committer there. But, yeah. And that's largely why I eventually let go of Capistrano. I just started feeling overloaded and overwhelmed and burnt out. And when you do that, you gotta take action. So
yeah, it makes sense. You know, it's, I think a lot of people miss the point that a lot of this is really about, you know, providing for other aspects of your life. And you know, if it interferes with those aspects of your life, then, you know, yeah, you've got to figure something out.
It was hard. I still feel a lot of attachment to Capistrano. You know, it was my baby, and it was hard to walk away, but it was a really good thing for me.
That makes sense. Do you have any recommendations for people who are looking to get involved in open source software?
Scratch an itch, honestly. I mean, you can always just pick some random project and look at the bug list and start hacking on it, but I find it's more fun, more rewarding to choose a project I actually use and find something that I feel is lacking or that it would benefit from and implement that. Because then you're scratching your own itch and you get to actually use what you made. But ultimately, just as long as you're hacking and submitting, I mean, that's a valuable skill to learn too, and you only learn by practice. So,
So I'm also curious then, what skills do you think are important for a Rubyist or Ruby on Rails developer?
I don't know that I'd say there's anything specific to Ruby on Rails developers, but, you know, programmers in general will always benefit from being curious. Troubleshooting is, being a good troubleshooter is largely being curious. Like, what if I do this? What if I do this? And seeing what changes and what happens and narrowing it down that way. But being willing to experiment, keep your skills sharp, learn new skills, and really become expert in your environment, whether that's your programming environment like Ruby and Ruby on Rails, or your editor, or, you know, anything in your tool chain, really, really come to know it. And for Ruby on Rails developers especially, I would encourage them not to be satisfied with just knowing the API and knowing how to build web apps, but really understand what's going on under the covers, because that's where you'll really start to excel. When you know why something works, it affects the way you use the API.
Right.
You start taking it a little further than you would have otherwise. Because if all you know is the API, you're always wondering, well, if I do that, is it going to break? And then you're hesitant to try it. But if you know what's going on under the covers, you know what the limits are going to be.
Where would you suggest people start?
Digging into Rails, you mean?
Yes.
Well, it's code spelunking is really
how I
learn stuff, where you pick some point in the interface, like active record find, for instance, or one of the active the action view template kind of system. You pick something and then you dig into it. You say, okay, let's imagine we're doing a simple active record find with an ID, and you dig through that whole path clear down until you do the SQL is emitted, and you get the result set back, and you trace it back up to how everything's put together.
Right.
And you do that for different cases, and honestly, that's I find that hugely educational.
Yeah, I'll bet. I bet
I need
that
to actually
really
get back into that, because Rails 3 is a black box to me. I've not done anything with it. I really keep intending to do some code spelunking there.
So are you actively developing in Rails right now for 37 Signals, or are you working on other things?
Yeah, it's all actively developed in Rails, if that makes any sense. Anyway, yes, we're doing all of our development in Rails.
Okay.
But most of our stuff is Rails 2. And there's some effort being put into migrating those to Rails 3, but there's still a lot of maintenance and new features and all that, and all that work is being done in Rails 2. Some of our newer stuff is Rails 3, but it all tends to be internal apps that we use internally.
Right.
And I've not had any experience with those yet. So.
So, how much have you done with Rails 3 then?
With Rails 3?
Yeah.
Almost nothing. I can't claim to have done anything at all in Rails 3. I might have tinkered with it on a side project, and I've probably looked at the source code for some of our internal apps that use Rails 3, but I haven't done any myself.
All right. I'm also curious, and I'm going to change tactics a little bit, but it is related to Rails tangentially, and that is that I saw in your blog that you mentioned that you had written some of your maze algorithms in CoffeeScript.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you like or dislike about CoffeeScript?
I like how it removes the warts from JavaScript. Like anyone who's ever done any like inheritance and tried to glue a class-based inheritance system on top of JavaScript knows what I mean when I say warts. Just you have to plug in the prototype and anyway, there's a lot of room for error. No matter how experienced you are, if you have 5 steps to do something versus 1 step, you're going to make mistakes sometimes. And CoffeeScript basically takes those 5 steps and turns them into 1 step. It gives you a sane class-based syntax that it then can reliably emit JavaScript for. So that's what I particularly enjoy about CoffeeScript, is that I don't have to think as much. I like that it borrows a lot of syntax from Ruby, so it's familiar to me that way. I'm comfortable in JavaScript, don't get me wrong, but the CoffeeScript is just more comfortable for me.
So I guess my next question is, and this is going to get into that mention of David again, do you think that, because it is another layer of abstraction, it's another place where something can technically go wrong, do you think that it's something that should be included by default in Rails?
CoffeeScript?
Yes.
I think it's a great idea for it to be in Rails. I don't know that it's necessary for it to be, but I am all in favor of it being there because I've used it and I find it so useful. And I totally understand David's point. He's not looking at these people with 5 years of Rails experience and saying they need CoffeeScript. He's looking at the people who are coming fresh to Rails, first learning web development. And yeah, they can benefit greatly from CoffeeScript. And that's why it's configurable. If you've been with Rails 5 years and you've got these huge JavaScript libraries and you know JavaScript back and forth, then yeah, don't use CoffeeScript. You might want to give it a try, though. I'd still recommend trying it, but I
And
think there's great benefit.
I happen to agree. I did a video on some of the basic features. I didn't get into the classes or class inheritance or anything in the video, but yeah, I mean, I've played with it some. I actually built a little bit of a dummy project in Rails 3.1 and played with some of the CoffeeScript features, and I really like it. I can see some people's point where they're saying, I don't want to have to take it out because I'm not going to use it, but at the same time, I think it really depends on how much payoff there is for what majority of the people as to whether or not it ought to be a default. But it's definitely something that people should be trying out.
If you're experienced in something and the default can be easily configured, then it makes sense for the default to be configured for the newbies. Because they're the ones that are going to have the harder time figuring out how to change. And they're going to have a hard time figuring out what to change. When you're new to something, there are so many options, it's overwhelming. And the idea behind Rails is for it to be a no-brainer to jump into something. So I think it totally makes people who are feeling pain. But these experienced people who are shouting about not wanting to have to reconfigure it, I think that's whining, honestly. If you don't like it, don't use it, configure it out of the way. It's not that hard. They've got the experience, they can do that. But for the new people, let's make it as easy and painless as possible to get them into Rails.
I have another question regarding Rails. Do you think that it's becoming more newbie friendly or less newbie friendly as it moves along?
I don't know that I would say that it has become more or less newbie friendly. New technologies come out like CoffeeScript, which enable different things. I don't know that I would say, but at the same time, Rails gets bigger and more features, more to learn. There's more there, more that you can configure if you need to. So on the one hand, I don't know. Overall, I'd say it's probably about a flat line, as far as someone new to Rails coming into it would probably feel as welcome today as they did 4 years ago. Just because the interface itself has been kept very simple. The introductory level is still very short step into it, regardless of how much more has been added.
Yeah, I generally agree. I get a little frustrated sometimes because I feel like some of the things that that are added. It's just not something that, I can see the newbies just latching onto and completely understanding. But at the same time, if you stick with the defaults, you can get something up and going pretty much as fast as you could have in the older versions. So,
and the thing about Rails too is that it's not just about making it easy, because PHP makes it easy, right? Rails is also about introducing people to the best practices. I hate that term, but it's about showing people what the right way to do something is.
Right.
And sometimes that right way is debatable. Is CoffeeScript the right way to do something? I think it's a right way. And whether you agree with it or not, it's a good way to approach JavaScript. May not be the way for you, may not be the way for everyone, but it's a good way to introduce people to client-side dynamic behavior.
Yeah.
So that's really, I guess, if it comes to that, I think Rails, whether Rails is easier or harder for newbies coming in right now, it's definitely showing them more better practices.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it really gives you a framework. I guess it is a framework, but it gives you a way of organizing your code and your functionality so that it's easy to manage and it makes sense. And I think between that and then the API being generally as simple as it is, it really just opens things up so that, a lot of the tricky stuff just gets out of your way. You don't have to worry as much about SQL. You don't have to worry as much about some of these other technologies. If you don't get JavaScript, then yeah, CoffeeScript is great. Or if you're tired of dealing with some of the tricky stuff or just ugly parts of JavaScript, then it's also really nice. And, just to have that get out of your way and, you get the overall feeling for how things work and a way to deal with it. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I generally agree with what you're saying.
Cool.
So, It sounds like you've gotten into Rails quite a bit and dug pretty deep on that. Have you done any of that with Ruby? Have you dug into any of the internals there? Or?
Not for a few years, but I dug quite a bit into like the parser and SQLite Ruby. Those were C bindings. So digging into how the API works and when I first actually one of my motivations way back in learning Python and Ruby was, I can't remember specifically what I was trying to do, but I needed a native interface to something. Might have been a database or something even. This was back when I was doing the Dungeons and Dragons utility stuff, and I think I was looking for a database. Anyway, and so that's one of the things I liked about Python, was that it had a fairly clean native interface, and I enjoyed playing with some of that. But then I found Ruby, and Ruby's is the nicest I've seen. Like, it just has a beautiful API. Not perfect. There's warts in it, too. But one of the first things I did with Ruby was to dig deep into it and see, how the garbage collection system works and how the parser works and the runtime, how everything gets interpreted. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I keep meaning to do the same with Ruby 1.9 to take a look at the bytecode interpreter and things like that, but haven't gotten that far yet.
Yeah, have you had much chance to play with some of the other Ruby implementations like JRuby or Rubinius? Or?
Well, I've downloaded them and executed some Hello Worlds on them. Rubinius is another one I really want to look under the covers in. I've heard some wonderful things about it. And JRuby, I still have major scars from Java because of how it was implemented at my previous job. And so I've been reluctant to go there, which is silly because JRuby is a wonderful environment and praise to the skies, and rightly so. Everything I've heard about it is wonderful, but I've just been slow to get there. So,
right. I'm also a little bit curious, and this is related to the last question, but it's a little bit different. The Ruby implementations of Ruby 1.8 and Ruby 1.9 don't have, well, they use the GIL, and they have some threading issues, and so I'm a little curious as to, if you think it's important for us to move on to to be able to handle threads and what a difference that would make in the Ruby community as a whole?
I think the vast majority of people using Ruby are using it non-concurrently,
mm-hmm.
which means, Gil or not, it makes no difference.
Right.
For those people doing serious concurrency stuff, yeah, then it becomes frustrating to have that performance hit. But honestly, if Ruby is going to support high concurrency implementation, like high concurrency applications,
mm-hmm.
I think more needs to happen than simply removing the global interpreter lock. And I'm not an expert on this. I'm not a good one to speak at length on Ruby concurrency. But my experience is there are other languages that handle concurrency much better, but at the cost of a poorer syntax and a more obscure syntax. I'm looking at you, Erlang, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful concurrency, horrible syntax.
Right.
I've been meaning to look at Raya, actually, which is the syntax, it's the Ruby-inspired syntax that compiles to the Erlang VM.
Hmm.
I think that's a promising approach as well. But something like that, I think, might need to happen to Ruby itself to really bring it efficient, high concurrency features. Like I said, I'm totally not making stuff up as I go, but this is just my uninformed opinion. So,
well, that's fine. That's all I'm really asking for with these interviews.
Sure.
So I have two more questions, and these are questions that I try and ask everybody that comes onto the podcast, and I haven't been so good about asking them lately, but I'm going to ask you, in your opinion, what makes a great developer? And what I mean by that is, if you had to pick, you know, three or four people that you had to work with day in and day out, what specific skills or personality traits would you want them to have?
Balance, I think, would be the big one, first up. If all they do is programming, first of all, they're a health risk. A mental health risk, really, because that'll burn you out. If you see them working hard all the time on just programming, then you feel guilty because you're not.
Uh-huh.
But people who have a wide variety of other hobbies and interests are interesting to hang out with because they, you know, you learn new things when you're with them. They talk about fascinating things. It's like David races cars, and it's fascinating to hear him talk about that and show videos from his races. Mark Imbracco was learning to fly airplanes, and that was fascinating to hear his experiences with that. And anyway, it's more interesting when people have a balance in their life. Aside from that, I would strongly encourage curiosity, like mm-hmm. I was saying earlier, an interest in looking deeper and understanding how things work. Not taking things for granted. That leads to the whole cargo culting phenomenon. You just say, this works, it's good enough, and we'll run with it.
Right. Everybody's using it.
Yeah. It's like I was saying, I can't remember if I said it at that user group or not, but just if you can explain your stance on any tool that mm-hmm. you use and explain why you use it versus any other tool, you're okay. But if you say, I use this because it was the first thing I found, or so-and-so recommended it, and I just kind of run with it, I don't think that's good enough, and that's dangerous. But if you can sit down and say, I use Vim because this, and I don't use TextMate or Emacs or whatever because of this, yeah, that's good enough. So that's what I would look for, someone who can dig deep, understand, you know, the reasons behind their choices and speak intelligently about them.
Hmm. All right. I think those are all important things. And I think if we develop those skills too, that we become better developers.
Definitely.
So my other question is, what resources do you recommend people go check out to learn to become better developers or even just to learn interesting technologies?
That's a good question. I'm not one who learns well by reading, whether it's blogs or books. Mm-hmm. I have to do things like hands-on. And so the books that have inspired me have been ones like Seven Languages in 7 Weeks,
mm-hmm.
where it's very hands-on. Also, it's the enterprise. What's the one about unit testing by Kent Beck? Anyway, that one, I got about halfway through it because the first half of it was very hands-on and illustrative that way. So as far as resources, it's hard for me to say other than, you know, go to the language's website and download it and install it and start playing. But, you know, blogs and tutorials that walk you through, you know, real applications as opposed to Hello World applications, I think, are great resources. That's what I've tried to do with the maze algorithm posts that I've done.
Right.
Make something where someone could come in and say, yeah, I think I could do something like that in my own pet language, whatever, you know, and as opposed to a Hello World where you read three lines of code and you're like, this is boring. I'm going to go to another place. So that's what I look for, but I can't really think of any examples offhand. So except for my blog. Read my blog.
Right, of course. And that's weblog.jamesbuck.org.
Yes.
All right. So I think one resource that you kind of talked your way around there is GitHub, where you can go and dig into the code.
Excellent, you know? Yeah. Good point. GitHub, I've used that a lot, actually, looking for CoffeeScript examples or Objective-C examples to go and see how other people have done it. And that reminds me, another resource that I found invaluable when I was doing some iOS development was actually Stack Overflow.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Because it's full of real-life examples where someone got stuck and real people responding and saying, here's how you can work around that.
Yep.
So in general, I'm skeptical of sites like that, but I think Stack Overflow is exceptionally well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get a lot of it right. And the nice thing is that, you know, they have the voting feature on there. So generally, the best answers are going to be the ones that rise to the top.
Right.
And so yeah, it's a really, really nice example or really nice place to find examples of how to work around things. And I'll do a Google search, and about 75% of the time, my answer will come up on Stack Overflow.
Yeah, that's what I found, too, with the iOS stuff.
Yeah. In fact, Michael Hartle, I talked to him. He wrote the Ruby on Rails tutorial, and for when people contact him for support on learning Rails, he actually recommends that they go post their question on Stack Overflow and then send him a link, and then he'll go answer it on Stack Overflow so that other people can find the answer.
That's brilliant. That's a really good idea.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to throw in one last question.
Okay.
And this is because you're a strong Vimmer and I'm not, and I keep going back and forth as to whether I want to learn Vim or Emacs at this point. I feel like I'm constrained a little bit too much sometimes with TextMate. And so I'm curious as to what resources you would recommend for somebody who's trying to learn Vim.
The online help system in Vim, like within Vim itself, help, is fantastic. It is by far the most amazing resource for Vim that I've seen. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've never seen another application with a help system as well integrated and rich as Vim's. Mm-hmm. So it has a tutorial in there that'll walk you through stuff, and it's just so easy to just browse through it and find new tips and tricks. Every time I open the Vim help system, I'm like, wow, I didn't know you could do that. I learned something every time. So right. I strongly recommend that. That's about the only resource I can think of that I would recommend. I mean, Vim Golf is nice, but it doesn't give you clues as to how to accomplish the stuff.
Right.
But once you've got some experience under your belt, you can start doing the Vim Golf, and that's a great way to build your skill too.
Yeah, one thing I heard about Vim Golf was that you submit your answer, And then you get to see the next couple ahead of you. And so then what you can do then is you look at those and you try and figure out what they did. But all you have to go off of is the keystroke. So
yeah.
I can see that getting a little tricky.
Yeah, it's definitely a little cryptic. So, but the Vim help system is seriously amazing.
All right. I think the other thing I have to do is I need to just pick one and then commit. And stop using TextMate and start using that so that I
can
force myself in.
There's a lot of religious war between Vim and Emacs, you know, and some of it's lighthearted and some of it's not. And it drives me nuts when people start bashing one or the other, because honestly, it's whatever works for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I would strongly recommend you choose one and use it exclusively for a week or two or longer, and then choose the other one and use it exclusively for a week or two or longer. Just get to where you can be productive in both and then decide which one actually fits your philosophy best. Because for me, having to hold down the control key while I do stuff, that's the thing that's kind of turned me off of Emacs.
Right.
Whereas Vim, all the commands, not all. I mean, obviously some of them are control and so forth too, but the controls feel more immediate to me. I also love the two-mode interface that Vim has. So.
Right.
But, that, you know, I've tried Emacs, and it just wasn't for me, and Vim is, so.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there with the holy war brewing, and I just want to thank you for coming on the podcast again. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This was fun.
It was fun. And you know, it's so interesting because I bring people like you, or last week I talked to Tom Preston Warner from GitHub, and, you know, I learned so much from you guys, and I just appreciate that, you know, there's so many people out there who are willing to give up a half hour or hour of their time to talk to me and, you know, answer some of my questions, answer some questions that I know people who listen to this have, and, you know, really just, you know, give back in another way. So thanks again.
Sure. Thank you.
All right, we're back. Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. It's always so fun to talk to people who have such a wide breadth of knowledge. And I really appreciate Jameis coming and talking to us and, you know, sharing his expertise with us. Now, you may have noticed that there was a little bit of audio quality difference on the last podcast. I recorded them using Ecamm call recorder on my computer. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how I want to make these work. I've had to record the Skype calls into my computer at this point. I do want to get things set up so that I can do a Skype mix minus through my computer. I may wind up having to do that through my laptop. Anyway, just let me know if there were issues so that I can jump on those, because I really want to make sure that this is the highest quality podcast out there that you can get. Anyway, I want to remind you that if you do need help with your Ruby or Rails application, you can contact me at 801-367-6164. You can also email me, Chuck, at teachmetocode.com, and you can find me on Twitter at cmaxw. If Facebook is your thing, then you can find me on Facebook at charlesmaxwood, facebook.com/charlesmaxwood. I'm going to warn you, though, I play a lot of Frontierville, so you're going to want to block that unless you play the game too. Other than that, I don't really have anything to add. I want to thank New Relic for sponsoring the show, and I want to thank Jameis again for coming on to the podcast. Finally, I just want to tell you to go out there, build something cool, and remember that writing the code is the easy part.